on us. 15 seconds. Guidance is internal. 12, 11, 10, 9. Ignition sequence starts. 6, 5, 4, 3, 2.
If there's one thing I can't stand, it's a smart
LA kid. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, stand to reason. And I'm glad you're with me today. 1-800-227-5278 is my number, and that's the line for intelligent discussion on anything in the areas of ethics, values, and religion. The Orange County number is 714-754-4150. That is, if you're in the 714 area code, you can just dial that number direct, 754-4150. And love to talk with you today, and our enforcer this today will vet your call and put you through if you're nice to her and you've got something to say. The rule here, of course, is that you give me a piece of your mind, and I'll do my best to give you mine, a piece of mind. Just a personal note today, by the way. My little girl, Annabeth, now 9 months and 2 weeks old, said her first word yesterday. She's actually been working on this one for a while. And no, it wasn't Daddy or Papa or, Calvinism. it was Duck. She's been working on this because she's got a little yellow duck. Yes, I think so. It's appropriate. And for the last few days, it's been coming out kind of guck. And you never know when you're trying to make a sound or a word or something that she's not just repeating your sounds, you know. We've been working on this, and she's been able to say a number of things, but it's just repetition of sounds. The key is whether the sound becomes a signifier, whether this word is connected to the object. And as we've been working on this, my mother-in-law, Trova, presented our little girl with the duck yesterday. It's a little yellow ducky that she has in her bathtub. You know those things. And she looked at it and just said simply, duck. Just like that. Of course, Mommy and Daddy were thrilled, and we worked on it for a while. And in fact, she got the word out so clearly. I mean, it was like duck when we were working with her. And then she was so thrilled with her, you know, and I actually think she knew, she made a discovery, because now she's associating it with this thing. In fact, I hid the little critter underneath the on the bed, underneath the sheet. You know, I said, where's the duck, Annabeth, where's the duck? And she'd find the duck and then get all excited. So now she knows that duck is a duck, or at least that little yellow thing, a bright yellow thing. I don't know entirely whether she thinks that duck means yellow, as opposed to that thing. But anyway, in any event, there's an association. We'll work on the distinctions later. But, it was as if she really got excited because she was able to make a connection with a word and the thing it signified. And, I mean, really, when she would say it, and, of course, we'd cheer her on and everything, but we cheer for her lots of times and she doesn't react. This time she was so jazzed because now she's starting to talk. She's starting to connect words to objects, tokens to their signifiers, and to their types, as it were. Anyway, so that's a big step for us at the Kokel household. Of course, I think we might have created a monster because she's making lots of noise all the time, and maybe she'll follow in Dad's footsteps in this regard. Maybe we'll bring her on in a couple weeks, and she can say, duck for you, and maybe something more profound, like infralapsarian Calvinist. In any event, we actually had a big, significant rite of passage on Wednesday morning because, we've adopted this little girl, but she's been in our care as a foster child until the legal work got done. That was accomplished on Wednesday, and we actually went into Compton, which is the L.A. Superior Court in our area, and did the final paperwork. And it was kind of interesting because we were told to be there at 8:30 in the morning. And so I'm thinking that at 8:30 they're going to call our name to come before the judge. And the judge is going to be tapping her foot, wondering where the Kokels are at. So I was really keen on getting there in plenty of time, you know. And we got a little behind our time, at least by my schedule. So I was a bit nervous, although we did end up getting there at about 20 after 8. And we went upstairs and got through the security and went upstairs. And there we were right on time, only to find the door to the chambers locked. Because nothing happens before 9 o'clock, minimally. They just told everybody 8:30 because they figured people are going to be late. So there we were sitting there in front of family court here, and this is where the folks come in, you know, for, you know, where the, what is that called when the judge says, you know, you can't come within a mile of my kid kind of thing, restraining orders and deadbeat dads and all that other stuff. Now, at least it wasn't the criminal court where you, who knows what you're going to run into, but it was still a seedy crowd, you know, they're collecting around us. But they were very friendly because here we've got this little redheaded girl. And finally, the doors open up, and we noticed on the docket our name didn't appear. All these other people were also scheduled at 8:30. We thought we had an actual appointment. I mean, just for us, 8:30 for the Kokels, you know, dinner for four kind of thing. And it turns out, no, everybody was there at 8:30, or that was their appointment. And then you kind of had a number on the docket, and that was the order in the queue that you took in order to see the judge. Well, our name wasn't even on there. So when we got up to the bailiff, we said, gee, we're not even on the list there, because he wanted the number. And he said, that's okay, what are you doing? And I showed him our paperwork, which showed the date and everything. We were there just as we were supposed to. He said, well, we'll take that. Don't worry. Sit down right there in the front row. And then after he got all the people, then he ordered – well, he gave his pitch about here are the rules. You know, here's the way we do things here at The Rock, you know, kind of deal. And he gave all the rules, and one of them, which is you can't have kids in the courtroom. Oh, great, you know. So when he was all finished, he said, do you have any questions? And, of course, I raised my hand. I said, well, we got a kid in the courtroom, but this is an adoption deal. He said, yeah, don't worry, but that doesn't apply to you. And then after he took the question, he said, okay, now that everybody's here, everybody's got to leave because we have a private matter before the court, and we want to clear the courtroom. Oh, great. All right, well, that's the system. So we all got up to go, and he came over to us, the bailiff, and said, no, no, you guys sit down. Turned out the private matter before the court was the Kokel adoption. And so they emptied the courtroom of everyone except for the deputy, the court reporter, the translator, and the clerk, and the judge who was still in chambers and yet to come out. And, you know, it was like the whole atmosphere changed when everybody left the room, because now it was just my wife and I and the baby. And that baby, if you've met this little baby, she's a darling little kid. I mean, I know I sound like the proud dad, but that's what everybody else tells me. She's a crowd pleaser. She's very pleasant. And she's got red hair, and she's cute. I mean, so what more can you ask? She's engaging with people. And, I mean, at 9 months, what more can you ask? So she just got a sweet personality, and so people turn on to her. And that's what happened. All four people in the courtroom then that were left lit up and came over and were gurgling and cooing with the baby and wanting to hold her and talking and whatever. And even the tough bailiff with the badge and the gun, you know, he was all melting looking at little Annabeth. And, in fact, they said, did you bring the camera? I said, well, we did. We didn't know we could use it. Oh, yeah, go ahead. You know. And then the judge comes in, and then he's talking, and he's so glad that we're there because usually darker matters are resolved at this court than what we're to do that day. And he said, it's good to have something like this. So we went through the details, and it was pretty much pro forma, and he read the lines. And it was almost like, do you promise to have and to hold and to cherish and from this day forward until death do you part kind of thing for the baby? I mean, it's very similar, and it was kind of like I now pronounce you mother and father kind of thing. After which I said, can we kiss the baby? And she said, yeah. He said, yeah. And you know what was really cool is everybody in the courtroom, those four people now with the judge five, after he made the final proclamation and this baby's now officially a member of our family legally, they all applauded. I thought that was really cool. How often do you get an applause in a courtroom? You know, that was just wow. And then the judge came down, and we had a picture with him, and he gave us his private email number so we'd make sure to send a picture to him. We got the rest of the crew together, and all the ladies, and they got a picture with the baby, and they all gave us our email numbers, so we sent it out, and then they finally let us go. Now, I was feeling a little badly for all of the folks that were still stuck in the waiting room, I mean in the hallway, waiting for this private matter, which they know had to do with us. But so we were trying to move things along just out of consideration for them. I guess the whole thing took about half an hour. But when we came out, people were nice, smiling, and kind of applauding a little bit for the great news, the great thing that had just transpired. But, you know, one of the questions that came up during that time, that private time in chambers was or in the courtroom, was that, you know, where did you adopt the baby from? Now, many of you know we adopted this baby from Southern California. But it's interesting to me that people consistently ask. In fact, it's one of the first questions they ask when we mention that this baby is an adopted child. From where did we adopt this child? And they don't mean where in the country. They mean what country. where in the world did this baby come from? Obviously, this baby didn't come from China, where a lot of babies are adopted from, the Pacific Rim, maybe the Soviet Union or some Eastern European country or something like that. Now, and they're a bit surprised to find that we've adopted here in the States. And I always take an opportunity to make a point about this whenever anybody raises the question. And in fact, here I was in the middle of the court with all these court officials there, and I took the same opportunity I always do. Because my question is, why is it that you ask where this baby is from? And the answer is because so many babies are adopted overseas. And then another question, and you can see the Colombo tactic working here. In fact, this is something, if you have an adopted child and people are asking you the same question, I'm sure they are, by the way, maybe you might take instruction from this series of questions. I say, why do you ask what country? Well, it's just rare for kids to be adopted here in this country. It seems like all the people we know that are adopting overseas, and I think that's true. And I said, why do you think they're not adopting kids in this country? Now, I suspect if people are observant, they're going to know the answer, because there's not many babies. The waiting lines are too long. People who want to adopt would love to adopt in this country. They don't, because the babies aren't available. And so they go overseas. Somebody told me this morning they thought it's cheaper to go overseas. I mean, think about it. First, you got to travel to China, both of you, and stay for weeks sometimes before the red tape is cleared. And these countries have a vested interest in these transactions. Do you think they're going to be interested in a little of the cash one way or another? You don't pay money for babies. That's slavery. But, you've got administrative fees and that kind of thing. And so it takes longer. There's more red tape, and it's a lot more expensive overseas than it is here. Our cost was about $16,000 for the whole process. That's cheap. Overseas, you're talking $20,000, $25,000 to $40,000 to $60,000 and up, depending. Why would somebody pay all that extra money? Because the children aren't here. And then comes my final question. Why aren't their children here? And the answer is because they are being killed at the rate of 3,000 a day through abortion. That's the answer. No, I don't make – I'm just trying to pass some facts on. I don't get on my high horse or my bully pulpit or anything at that point and try to give everybody I talk to a lecture about abortion. I just want that fact to sink in, and I made that point right there in the court. I just want that fact to sink in, because 3,000 and plus, I mean, it's 3,000 to 4,000 depending on what day of the week on average for 30 some years are being destroyed. No wonder there's no kids here. By the way, just another observation, and this is just it's just a fact, all right? And I don't have to editorialize on this at all, but it's kind of interesting, and a number of people have observed this. This isn't my idea. A lot of those kids, maybe the majority of those kids, I would say clearly the majority of those kids, that is more than 50%, are from families whose political affiliation is not Republican but Democrat. Now, why do I know that? Because Democrats are pro-choice and Republicans aren't. They're pro-life. I mean, on balance, that's the views, okay? So Democrats are more likely to have abortions of their children than Republicans. I mean, Republicans still do too, but now, probably the best indicator of what any child will be politically is the family that they grew up in. Therefore, if there are more abortions in Democratic families, then there are going to be fewer children that would have been Democrats and therefore would have voted Democrat, according to the Democratic Party, when they grew up. Now, let's see. It's been over 30 years since Roe v. Wade. That's a whole lot of voting Democrats that aren't in the pool, ladies and gentlemen. Do you think that might have shifted the balance of the last couple of elections? No question. And so there's this kind of political reflection that it's going to be very difficult, some have said, for Democrats to win any election of the president in the next 20 years, because they haven't produced enough kids over the last 20 years that are Democratic to vote. It could be the country shifts to the other side. Who knows? That could happen. But it's just a curious thing, isn't it? By the way, thinking about or talking about this abortion question, you must have heard about the USC student, Holly Ashcraft, 21 years old from Billings, Montana. 21, that would make her like almost a senior, right? So here's a USC senior. It's not easy to get into USC. I mean, I know it's expensive, but I think aren't there kind of academic requirements that are – yeah. So this is not a backwoods girl, if you could put it. This is somebody who's presumably worldly wise. Here she gave birth to a full-term baby boy, put him in a cardboard box, and dropped him in a trash bin near USC. She's being prosecuted. Frankly, I hope they throw the book at her. I have no sympathy whatsoever. Why should I? Why should anyone have sympathy for Holly Ashcraft, who dumped her baby boy into a trash bin where he died? Now, some have noted, gee, maybe since she was from Montana, she wasn't aware of the California law, which says that you can drop your baby off at a hospital or a police station or a fire department or something like that, and nobody will ask any questions. Well, I think that's good. It's good that that's available. But you don't have to have a degree in law in order to figure out that maybe any doorstep is better than a trash bin. Good night. The article goes on to quote the, the district attorney who's handling this. And he says, the tragedy of this case is the public needs to be aware that there is this law. He's the deputy district attorney. That's the tragedy, that she didn't know about the law that allows a mother to relinquish an unwanted newborn at any hospital or fire station, no questions asked. The tragedy is she didn't know about the law. The tragedy is that on her own she couldn't think of anything better to do with her unwanted baby than dump it. Seems to me. And then we have the remark of Andor. Now, fasten your seatbelts. Andor owns the building and other rental properties in the area, but the building where Miss Ashcraft lives. Quite shocked, actually, by what happened. Understandably, she seemed like such a nice girl. It seems really out of character for her, her friends would say, okay. But Andor is not only shocked, but she's a bit protective of Holly Ashcraft, quoting here. I feel like I need to protect her. I'm not justifying what she's done, but I just don't like her to be judged. I feel like I need to protect her. I'm not justifying what she's done, but I also don't like her to be judged. Is there something morally suspect about a judgment in this case? Is the judgment more heinous than the thing that she did? I mean, sometimes you notice how people say this. I know I wouldn't agree with that, but, you know, you shouldn't judge her, which itself is a judgment, by the way, as you know. And it's almost like the judgment is more offensive than the act that the person is judging. I know she killed her baby, and I don't approve of that. But you shouldn't be judging. They can't bring themselves to judge the girl, but they can bring themselves to judge the judger. I just don't like her to be judged. Well, she should be. She should be judged by the law, and she should be judged by all of us, because what she did was indefensible. And that we could countenance such a thing, that is, we shouldn't be judging her, that such a thing could make it into the paper. People would feel sorry for 21-year-old Holly Ashcraft because she dumped her baby into the dustbin, is a sign of the times. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason, taking your calls, 1-800-227-5278, back in just a moment.
You know the feeling, unsure, tentative. you remain quiet, or you're just angry. The feeling you get whenever the conversation turns to your faith and values. Want to increase your confidence and skill in discussions and feel confident when you speak up? Then Tactics is for you. Learn the techniques Greg Kokel has taught thousands of others that will help put you in the driver's seat in every exchange. You'll learn specific skills to help you initiate conversations effortlessly. Stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables. Graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking. Maneuver through minefields and present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. You'll learn some simple tactics and skills that will have you interacting and conversing with confidence about what you believe and why. Tactics will teach you how, as you listen and follow along while Greg walks you step by step through the material as your personal tutor. Soon, your conversations with friends will look more like diplomacy than warfare, and you'll be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present your faith and the reasons why Jesus Christ is the answer. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order. 1-800-2-REASON. Or go to the web at str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Oh, that's nice. Now that's Bach, right? Sounds like it to me. Greg Kokel here, back with you on Stand to Reason. And is that Chris Parkening doing the... yes, it is. Christian man, one of the best guitarists in the world. Let's see. Time to go to the phone, so let's do that right now. John in Huntington Beach, thank you for calling, John. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Greg. Sure. Yeah, I'm going to make a comment about a poll this week and an article about the loss of manners in the society and rudeness, and it ties in with so many things. And, you know, just like that comment you were making about that Holly Ashcroft, that's something you never would have seen a generation ago.
I mean, no, certainly not.
And the callousness and the coldness, you know, I look at the way people are these days, and to me sometimes their coldness and their cold-bloodedness is no different than people who lived in foreign dictatorships, and it seems to be a mentality that people are adopting in this country.
Yeah, you know what? It's ironic, though. I'm sure that Andor thought that who made the comment that I don't think she should be judged. I think that Andor probably considered that this was a charitable, kind, gracious, loving thing to say. That the loving thing, we ought to be loving to people and kind to people. I'm sure that Andor's a very nice person. I think she's deeply confused here. And you're right about this. We've been so socialized in the direction of relativism that making substantive judgments on things that are really bad turn out to be the worst things for us to do. We shouldn't be doing that.
Well, we
should be loving and being kind, you know, to people who do really bad things, not judging them. And so the judger is worse than the perpetrator of the crime.
Well, you know, let me put it this way: if some celebrity or somebody acts like a jerk, sure, that's a judgment, but it's the truth. If a person's nice, in other words, respect can't be demanded; it has to be earned. If somebody is worthy of it, and it's just like these athletes and these, you know, I see the way they act with all the money they're making, and you know, and the same thing with the owner of the Yankees. You know, he gets so caught up in his emotions sometimes, trying to blame his manager for everything. I lose respect for people like that because I work with people that are control freaks.
Yeah.
Okay, well, am I being judgmental? Yeah, but but this is going to dovetail with something I want to share.
Okay, but we agree then there's a place for judgment. There's an appropriate place for judgment, and these people get silly in their avoidance of judgment, even though, of course, she's not avoiding judgment. She's judging people who judge.
So she's doing the very thing she's
absolutely doing. Yeah, it's a suicide situation there, yeah.
It's absurd. The Daily News, which emanates from the Valley yesterday, had a really great article called How Rude, and it says, poll Americans getting worse at minding their manners, and this dovetails with a lot of what you talk about in your show. And I think that the lack of manners reflects, and the civility reflects the coarsening of our society. And they were asking people questions in here like, what are the reasons? Parents not teaching good manners to children, people leading busier lives, the influence of all the massive technology, and people not taking time for politeness, TV shows and movies that show rude behavior and vanity and mean-spiritedness.
I don't know that politeness takes time, by the way. I don't know where that comes. We don't want to take time for politeness. It doesn't take time. You know, I don't get that. But I think you're right. The models that we see in culture are the other direction, right?
People are so impatient in any way. And then celebrities, athletes, and public figures behaving rudely and being poor role models, the whole thing.
Yeah.
But there are just a couple quotes here, and I'll let you go. This one psychologist was saying they were just saying, but people see a far fairer picture when they look at themselves in the mirror. In other words, she was saying it's like I have a right to say what I think. In other words, about other people being rude, but a lot of the people in this poll are themselves rude themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's very common for people not to see their own behavior as problematic now.
Mm-hmm.
And just and I'll be done in a second here. And then they were talking to some other people in here, and one of them was saying that our society has become so impatient. People become ill-tempered. They're used. It's like entitlement. You know, the entitlement on demand and spoiledness. And I was thinking of like when Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you."
Uh-huh.
Gone completely from that to the opposite, which is I want what I want when I want it.
That's right.
And I try to be an optimist. I heard Dr. David Jeremiah this week talking about Revelation and the end times and God's judgment, and he said, folks, he goes, all you got to do is look around you and look at the behavior in our society. Do you really think it's getting worse or better?
Mm-hmm.
And I try to be an optimist, and I'm a strong person of faith, being a Christian like you.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like we're in a brainwashed state, like people have come to become cynical, Greg, and they tolerate and believe something, even if it's wrong. And it's like when people are brainwashed, it's the hardest thing to try to get them away from believing something.
Yeah, well, I don't know so much. I think the word brainwashed is
a
strong word, but and that's a technical issue. I don't really know that I believe in that thing. But I understand there's an indoctrination, certainly, where people are influenced.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're influenced by their culture. But, you know, I think it comes down to, and I don't want to keep banging the same pot, but you know, when relativism is the air you breathe,
yep.
When there is no right and wrong, when there is no truth of any kind, where it's not surprising that kids start getting a little bit narcissistic, because what the heck else is there? There is nothing else. There's nothing greater than you. There's nothing beyond you. There's nothing transcendent. There's just you and your pleasures. And so I'm not surprised that people would look in the mirror and say, well, I'm it, and it's my rights.
What I find disturbing is that so many adults, baby boomers and older people that know better, are leaving this world and getting older, and it's like
the demographics are changing.
They're changing.
Yeah, radically.
And so they're not speaking out, and they're not leaving anything, and it's like they're just patting themselves on the back, and I think that's a terrible legacy to leave these kids. They have nothing to work with.
I agree with you. John, thanks so much for the call.
Keep it up.
Okay, I will. And I have more to say about this. We mentioned the mirror. You know, the Bible talks about a mirror, too, and about looking into the mirror. But the mirror the Bible talks about looking into is the law. That is, the law reflects back to us exactly what we're like, because we see that we don't measure up to it. Now, if you don't put the law in the mirror, if the law isn't the mirror reflecting back to us what we're really like, identifying our selfishness and self-centeredness and fallenness, if you deny there is such a law, when you look in the mirror, all you see is yourself. In other words, you become the center of your own existence. So it's not surprising that people are so self-centered, and they don't know what to do. And with regards to John's comment that, you know, there's a generation dying off that had these qualities and virtues that haven't been doing a good job of passing it on. I was in a Starbucks this morning before I went to the church that I taught at in Simi Valley, and I pulled into the Starbucks and I got my coffee, and And sitting there with a young man was an older man, and I looked at the resemblances, and I just get the sense of the conversation that was going on as I waited to get my coffee. This was a father and son, except for the son was real hip-looking, really cool, and just carrying on about his own life and what he's doing, and his language was peppered with foul words. Now, this kid couldn't have been older than 18. I get the feeling like he thinks he's a grown-up now, so he can just fire these words out. And that's what it means to be grown-up, to talk like this. But he was talking like this to his dad. In fact, I know it was his dad because at some point dad mentioned something about mom. And, you know, to be honest with you, when I glanced over there, and I wasn't trying to eavesdrop or, you know, whatever, be rude, but I just saw the situation and I heard a couple of snatches of conversation. But I did look at the father, and he looked very uncomfortable. And I know that he probably wanted to try to relate to his kid, but what is he going to say? You know, you shouldn't use language like that. Probably when they're 18 or 19, it's the wrong time to bring something like that up. I think that this kid was following a pattern that had been laid in place long before it. And maybe this was a broken home. Oh, some people don't like that kind of terminology, but that's exactly what divorce is. It's a broken home. So maybe this means that we should have more of the mirror of the law telling us what's right and wrong so that we get a clear assessment of ourselves, and maybe we wouldn't be so rude. I think the whole rudeness thing applies to the broad principle in the scriptures, love your neighbor as yourself. And just be a good neighbor. Be respectful of others so that you're not acting in a way that makes them feel uncomfortable. That's what manners amounts to. Now, I have to say in confession, I understand about the impatience business because I get impatient myself with other people. But as I've been reflecting on this, and this is a vice in my own life, I complain because of my impatience. It's because, and I know what it is, think about it for yourself. When you start to complain and get impatient, what's the reason? It's because other people are inconveniencing you, right? Or me in this case. It's like, how dare them get in the way of my stuff, my goals, my desires, my wants. It's just arrogance and self-centeredness. That's all it is. And that's something the Holy Spirit's helping me to see, and I've got to deal with it. So I'm just like everybody else in that regard. But at least I have the mirror of the law to show me otherwise, to show me what the right way to walk is. Let's go out to Tennessee, and Nick, welcome to Stand to Reason, Nick. Greg Kokel, hi.
Hi, Greg. I haven't spoken to you in years.
Oh, it's nice to hear from you. I recognize your voice. Did I meet you at the Norm Geisler conference about 4 years ago?
Oh, yes, you did. I was here to everyone about that.
Well, it's a pleasure to talk to you again, Nick. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've found that read a lot of your writings also on Theology Web. I'm a member there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I've actually met you twice, and I think you had a – did you have a Stand to Reason hat one of those times?
You sold it to me.
Well, you probably got one of the last ones, so, you know, I hope you cherish it because we don't have any more. But what's on your mind today, Nick?
Yeah, first off, I really don't get to listen to your show, so I'm enjoying getting to hear you on.
By the way, Nick, do you know that we are now streaming live?
But I'm on a dial-up, and that's kind of...
Oh, it makes it a little bit more difficult. Well, just so people know, if they go to www.kbrt740.com, they'll be able to listen to the show live streaming, and it's a lot easier, as you pointed out, if you have broadband. But if you're on a dial-up, well, it's a little more difficult. But you can always keep downloading the shows, as you've been doing, Nick.
Well, I'm willing to move to Charlotte anyhow and go to SES myself. I got friends on T-Web that really like your program.
Okay.
Oh, I think of my friend RTP, for instance. You like to say she's very smurfy on there.
Uh-huh. Okay.
That's an inside joke. I said, let me get to my question, okay?
Okay. Will do.
Greg, I really love your teaching on God's will for your life and the idea of hearing the voice of God.
Right.
A friend of mine and I, we taught Sunday school, and we did 4 lessons on that, and the kids loved it.
Uh-huh. That's great.
I went to ask something about that.
About prayer?
Yeah, because men, I think, are more action-oriented, and we find it hard to do this. And I've been wanting to get a good book or something, but, you know, so much of the book is filled with this modern terminology. I want to make sure I'm spending my money, which is limited, on something worthwhile.
Okay. Let me give you a title, and let me say this first of all. I am not the best prayer warrior. This is not a strength in my life. And so I probably need to do more on this area. There is an ancient book or an older book that is I think it's entitled – well, a couple of titles come to mind, and these are older ones, so they're not going to be as influenced by this – modern lingo of hearing from God and listening prayer and all of these things that I don't think are actually biblical. So the author is E. M. Bounds, like E as in echo, M as in Mary, his first two initials, and his last name Bounds.
I've heard of that name before.
Yeah, well, as I recall, he's written a book on prayer that I read when I was a young Christian, and so you can check E. M. Bounds. And then there's another book called Christ in the Schoolhouse of Prayer. Now, it may be that he wrote that book. I can't remember. I mean, I'm just associating both titles, both these things, Bounds and Christ in the Schoolhouse of Prayer. I think that's the title, as good books on prayer, but in kind of an old-fashioned motif, and that means it's probably more theologically safe. I'll give you a more current author that I would strongly recommend that you consider for prayer. In fact, I'm going to recommend a book by this author that isn't directly on prayer, but it is on deepening your walk with the Lord. And I have been impressed by him. His name is John Piper.
Oh, yes. Desiring God.
Desiring God and Desiring God Ministries. And the book is actually, ironically, When I Don't Desire God. When I Don't, or maybe When We Don't Desire God. So that's the title. And that one has a kind of a step-by-step. Now, he isn't caught up into this other stuff, okay, just to let you know. But there is a very practical – I'm going through it now, and I'm just becoming familiar with the book, but I've read some things through it, and I've been very impressed. And there's some very, very practical things in there that have to do with Bible reading and prayer and the like that I think you'll find helpful. I think there's a whole chapter on prayer. And I think that John Piper is a very reliable person. Now, he's Reformed, as you probably know, and so he is going to be coming somewhat from that perspective, but that's kind of lurking in the background, the sovereignty of God and the glory of God kind of thing. But I think he's just a great writer, and I commend him to anybody, frankly, whether they're Reformed or not, whether they could be Arminian. There's probably tremendous things you can glean from his reflections on walking with God, and I think this book on When I Don't Desire God might be a good place to start. And then check for some other titles that he might have on prayer. That would be my recommendation, Nick.
It's really great to get to speak to you again, Greg. I love talking to you. I always tell people what I like about you, Greg, is that, you've got this great mind that I'm working towards developing, but you also seem like a guide just like me. You talk about going out, going to get coffee, things like that.
Well, sometimes it's more than coffee, but you get your point. I try to be down to earth. I mean, that's my style, and I don't think pretense is useful in the Christian life. And I sure appreciated you, Nick, when we met. And by the way, I want to just encourage you. I know you're working hard, and even when we talked last time, you're taking what you're learning and you're teaching other people with it. You're doing your Bible studies and your Sunday school classes. As I recall, there was a young man that was, or a gentleman that was one a person that you were mentoring, kind of, and discipling, that was in a wheelchair last time I saw you. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, he's doing great. He lives in Hawaii now.
Oh, he does. Suffering for the Lord there, huh?
Oh, yeah. I'd love to go there and suffer with him also. He lives also. Even more suffering.
Yeah, sure. Well, Nick, I've got to get going here, but I want to thank you for your call, and I just want to tell you to keep up the good work, okay?
And if you're on T-Web again, say hi to me, and I'd like to keep in touch with you somehow.
Okay.
Okay,
thanks a lot, Nick. I appreciate it. That's great to hear from Tennessee and Nick, who's doing the job for us, for the kingdom. 1-800-227-5278, Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Greg Coco with you here on Stand to Reason, the place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. And I welcome your calls here. With you every Sunday from 3 until 5. And also just a reminder that we are now, for those listening on the World Wide Web, many of you have been downloading our real audio and then later MP3 files for a long time. And our faithful listeners, now you can listen live to our show. We have live streaming. If you go to the website of our flagship station, KBRT, and that would be www.kbrt740.com. 740 is our place in the AM dial here in Southern California. If you go to www.kbrt740.com, you can listen live to our show, and that's a lot easier than downloading. Now, you can still do that from our site, but if you want to go listen live and stream and participate, call us in real time, as it were, you're welcome to do that. So that's great. And thanks to the Crawford Broadcasting Company for providing that for us here. Stand to Reason. Sunday next, on the 23rd, I'll be at New Song Church in San Dimas, California. That for the 9 and the 11 a.m. services. So if you'd like to connect with them out there and with me on the 23rd, here's the number you call to get the info, 909 area code 394-9488. That's 909-394-9488. Don't you hate it when people give you phone numbers on the radio and just zip right through it like that? 909-394-9488. I'll be talking about essential ambassador skills at the 9 and 11 o'clock service, New Song Church, San Dimas, on the 23rd. Hope to see you there. Let's see. What else do I have to say before I go back? Nothing. Back to the phones, and we've got a full bank of callers here. Glad to see that. Karen in Fullerton in Southern California. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Thanks, Greg. Hi, and sure. Congratulations on your adoption.
Yeah, you're welcome. I mean, thank you. I'm thrilled.
And I hope, I know someday you'll have the opportunity to be just really encouraged by your daughter, like I did was by my 19-year-old son a couple weeks ago when he called me from college and said that in his speech and critical thinking class, the teacher had asked who was a Christian to raise their hand. He was the only one.
Uh-huh.
And the professor spent 20 minutes ridiculing Christianity, and my son held his own, and the professor hasn't brought it up since.
Good for him. Well, that's great. You give him my kudos, okay?
Well, and you know, it's so much from the kind of ministry that you have. You've been in our home for, you know, years here. That, you know, you helped us out at a high school thing last year with my other son. And, and last year, in his freshman year in a speech class, he had had to do a persuasive speech and chose abortion as a topic. That professor raised his eyes and said that's really controversial, but he went ahead and did.
Well, what better topic for, I mean, if you're going to do a persuasive talk,
right,
the more controversial, the better.
Right. So,
seems
of course, he took the abortion one from the ABC curriculum and
Ambassador Basic Curriculum, right.
And based his presentation on that, had the rapt attention of the entire class.
Oh, that's great.
Had and just people asked real interesting questions. Of course, he got an A on the...
Oh, that's great. You know, we consistently get responses from people who use the abortion training material that we provide on our web, in the ABC kit there, or on Making Abortion Unthinkable, the Art of Pro-Life Persuasion. When they do debates, they get A's all the time, and people are astounded that they do such a careful job. And I've even had circumstances where we've had friends whose kids did the debate, and the people who opposed them on the pro-choice side changed their minds and became pro-life because, even though they were debating the other side. So we're in a sense not surprised, but always thrilled when that happens.
And other students said that it was really thought-provoking and gave them a lot to think about that they hadn't heard before.
You know, in a way, isn't that kind of sad? That for whatever reason, that people are not used to hearing a thoughtful presentation of the pro-life view? Now, it might be that the presentation doesn't get depressed when it's made. It might also be because many people aren't making that presentation, and so that's what we're trying to change that. It also strikes me as a little bit odd in one sense. I mean, not odd it's statistically. I hear this all the time that teachers ridicule Christians, but you got to think of it odd in another sense. It's very politically incorrect to make fun of somebody's religion in front of that person, in front of a classroom, for goodness sake. Would they ever do such a thing? Do you think any professor in this country, a single professor, would countenance doing anything like that with regards to Islam and a Muslim student?
Right.
And they're the ones who just blew up the World Trade Center a couple of years ago and are blowing up our boys in Iraq, you know, but no, they can't touch that.
And what was interesting in this most recent experience that he had is that this college campus, it's a state college here in California, is known for its large Christian community.
Really?
And I know
what college is it?
It's Cal Poly San Luis Obispo.
Huh.
And he was the only one to raise in his hand, but I know that's because he's had the confidence of the training, such as yours, that he's had in this home, and he went to Summit Ministries summer after he graduated. You know, he's listened to your tapes and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So he had the confidence to raise his hand.
Oof.
And after the class, he had a 30-minute conversation on spiritual things with a student he didn't even know sitting next to him.
Wow.
So it was very exciting, which brings me to the point of my call today.
Okay.
He went to a big...
Go ahead.
Say the name of the organization.
Campus Crusade for Christ. I see it here on the note.
Christ,
yeah,
conference this week.
It's public, right? So there's no...
It is.
Okay.
And after the... I guess they do this every fall, and have speakers and all this kind of thing. After the Saturday morning session, he called me and said, Mom, the speaker that was supposed to be here, he recognized as a speaker from an Orange County Emergent Church.
Yeah.
And... so they had a substitute speaker, and this speaker quoted Brian McLaren. And the quote, if I'm not sure I have perfectly right, but it was along the lines of, it's more important to do what's good than it is to do what's right.
Okay.
And that seemed to be the theme of the presentation.
Uh-huh.
They broke into small groups afterwards, and all the kids in the group were falling for it and agreeing with it until my son... started arguing against it, say no. It's more important to do what's right because then you'll do what's good. But what do you do with...
Okay, there's a bit of ambiguity here. And let me just toss out a couple of ideas first, and then we'll see, you know, if I can make more sense of this. There are many things that Brian McLaren has said that I think are worth quoting because I think they're prescient and insightful. And these have to do with a critique of evangelicalism that I think is on point to some degree. I don't want to overplay this, but it might be. I'm not dealing with this specific quote right now, but I'm not the kind of person who's going to have a knee-jerk response and say, if Brian McLaren says it, it must be bad, because that's certainly not the case.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of good things that he could say and offer, depending. Now, when it comes to this quote, it's more important to do what's good than to do what's right. Another thought. I mean, sometimes we say things in odd ways to get people thinking. I know that's true of McLaren. And think of our teaching, never read a Bible verse. Do you think that might be misunderstood if people don't understand the context?
Sure.
So I'm saying something that sounds a little bit bizarre to get people thinking, so they realize, I mean, never read a Bible verse. If you want to understand the verse, you got to read the paragraph or more is the point there. But it kind of gets them, it's a clever little handle. And so I have no problem with people using quotes that are iconoclastic or the kind of, kind of stir things up a little bit, as long as what's being done is productive. Now, here's my question is, to the specifics, it's more important to do what's good than to do what's right. I don't know what he means by the words good and right. If I had more of a context there, what he meant by good and right, then I'd be in more position to say whether I agree with him or not. I mean, I could say something like that, presumably, to get people's attention, and then I'd want to clarify exactly what I mean by good and right. It might be the case that I probably wouldn't say that. I might say it's better to do what's right than what's good, I might say, well, that sounds like a contradiction, but see, some things seem good in the moment because we want to be nice and whatever, but kind of go with the emotional thing of goodness rather than doing the proper thing of what's right. And, I mean, that would be the way I'd spin it. And if you do what's right, then in the long term, the goodness is going to result. But I'm not sure how he characterized it. Now, did your son give you any understanding about what the point was that he was making with that quote?
He was pretty upset, and he seemed to understand it as you're supposed to just do good things, and it doesn't matter if it's, right or true. I should have more of the context.
Yeah.
From his reaction, it sounded like you can make a good choice over the right choice.
Well, it might be, and again, I'm working in the dark here somewhat, given the postmodern influence of people like Brian McLaren and his new emphasis on social justice and stuff like that, and his critique of the church. He might think, well, the church is trying to do all the right things, and they end up not doing anything good. They end up ignoring the poor and end up, being dogmatic and narrow-minded and arrogant and intolerant. Now, I do not think that's an accurate assessment of the church as a whole. I mean, you always got screwballs, but I don't know of a single church that I've been connected with or involved with that isn't doing something for the poor. Not a single one. So, I mean, as an example, it may be that he's playing that out. He's trying to diminish Orthodox rightness, correct doctrine, and stuff like that, and all you guys thinking you're doing the right things because you got it all worked out and you know the right things to do. Instead, we should be trying to be good people. We should be loving our neighbors and not judging them and not putting them down, letting homosexuals get married and not telling people Jesus is the only way, because this upsets people and this isn't kind and loving and whatever. I think that's part of what the emerging church stands for. And so he might be making the distinction in that way. And if that's the distinction he's making, then first of all, it's a self-refuting enterprise because he's telling us what is right couched in the words of good. Don't do this. Don't do your way. Do it my way because my way is right, and I'm calling that good. Mm-hmm. So he turns out to be doing the same thing that he's telling the rest not to do. And secondly, it just turns out to be kind of a subtle, passive-aggressive kind of attack on people he doesn't like and views that he doesn't like. Mm-hmm. And it is tragic. If that's the pitch, it's tragic that, the crowd is responding in that way. You have to know what's true before you can know what's right. Mm-hmm. And you have to know what's true and right before you know what's good. I actually think of right and good as synonyms, so that's why it's an odd thing to say. But you have to know what the lay of the land is like, morally speaking. You have to have a map before you can navigate in your behaviors as a morally good person. And if you're just doing kind, good things to people, like feeding the poor, and you're not telling them what they need for eternal security, eternal goodness or sustenance, they're just giving them earthly sustenance, then you're missing something. Remember Jesus said in John chapter 6, do not hunger for the bread that perishes. And this is a lesson anybody who wants to emphasize the so-called social justice gospel over against the gospel of salvation. Jesus said, do not hunger for the bread that perishes, but hunger for the bread that comes down from heaven, that will give you eternal life, the bread of life, which he was. He told the woman at the well in John 4, he said, that water you drink will quench your thirst for the moment, but it won't quench your thirst forever. He was the living water. And so there is that contrast between the temporal satisfaction and the eternal goods. And the eternal goods, of course, are always more important. For those people who emphasize the temporal goods over the eternal rights, R-I-G-H-T-S, the moral things that have eternal consequences, you always want to start with the eternal consequences first. That was Jesus' message. That was Paul's message. That should be our message as well. Karen, it's so good to hear from you, and thank you so much for your call. And give us a report back when new things happen. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, hour number one behind us. We've got another hour ahead. 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. We'll be right back after this. Stay with us on Stand to Reason. You know, I wonder who that kid is. I don't know where we get that. Have to check that out. Greg Kokel here, Stand to Reason. The place where you get the other side, ladies and gentlemen, the truth. In fact, we don't teach you what to think. We teach you how to think here at STR. Now, my conviction, of course, Stand to Reason conviction, is that Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas if it's properly understood and properly articulated. We try to do both here every weekend, Sundays 3 to 5, and now, as you just heard, on the World Wide Web streaming from www.kbrt740.com. You can listen live and then call in, although we consistently get calls from outer climes there. In fact, we had a call from Tennessee. We've got one from Illinois sitting up here next. Columbus, Ohio coming in. El Cajon, that's Southern Cal, so that's the regular footprint, though. But we're glad to have all you guys on board, and maybe some of you are listening through the new streaming. So I hope you are and enjoying that. Coming up on the 23rd of this month, actually next Sunday, I'll be at New Song Church in San Dimas, California, 9 and 11 a.m. I'll be talking about essential ambassador skills. Now, you can always go to our website to find out where I'm speaking. And I've been bouncing around a lot the last couple of, the last month. The fall was really a busy time. I was in Dallas about 4 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago. 2 weeks ago, I was in St. Louis. Last weekend, I was in Olympia, Washington. This weekend, I was here in Southern California. But we jump around, and if you would like to know if I'm in your area, just go to our website at str.org, punch my face, and you'll get my schedule. It's that easy. And there'll be numbers there that you can call to get the details. In this case, for New Song Church, next Sunday, 909 is the area code, 394-9488. That's 394-9488, but that, of course, is on the website as well. So hope to see you there. I usually start out my second hour with some commentary. I've got so many callers on hold here, and glad to see that. I think I'll just go to them, many of them calling from out of town. So let's go to Illinois. And Paul, welcome to Stand to Reason, Paul.
Hi, Greg.
How you doing?
Very good. How are you?
Fine. Were you listening and streaming, or were you just downloading our MP3s?
I'm going to start listening and streaming now.
Oh, okay. Great.
I've got a question for you. I think it was last year you described compatibilism.
Uh-huh.
And you referred to John Piper's book, Desiring God.
Yes.
And that was extremely helpful, and I read that book as well, and
good.
Quite a bit. I had a chance to meet...
Let me ask you a question,
sure.
Paul. Does John Piper characterize himself as a compatibilist?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that, but
he's written some tremendous articles and sermons on it.
Okay, great. Just can I bring the audience up to speed on this term?
Absolutely.
For a moment? When people talk about free will and determinism, they toss the words around rather loosely without having done some thinking about what freedom is. And there are actually two different understandings of freedom. One is called libertarian freedom, and that is the view that most people think about. Libertarian freedom is the kind of freedom in which you could have done otherwise, the CDO requirement, could have done otherwise. So I could do this, and I choose to do this, but I could have done otherwise if I had chosen to do otherwise. Nothing compels me either way. Compatibilism, then you have on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have determinism, and that is that your decisions are made for you by some outside force, some particular thing that like dominoes falling, you don't control your choices. All your choices are made for you. Even though you feel like you're choosing, it's really just deterministic, and that's determinism, which I don't think is a Christian alternative. But in the middle is a view called compatibilism, also called soft determinism. And it's the view that is called compatibilism because it makes a certain type of freedom compatible with a certain type of determinism. And in compatibilism, the individual chooses, and he or she is free to choose in this sense, that there is nothing from the outside that is causing or forcing an individual to do anything. However, an individual still is driven by inner states, and they choose to do things because they are consistent with their nature. The classic example is, you know, if you have a favorite ice cream and you really like the ice cream, in principle, you have a choice. You're free to do anything, choose any other ice cream, but you never will because you always choose what you like. Now, I think that this concept can be pushed too far, and I don't want to overplay it or get into too much depth, but just to let the folks know that when it comes to Christianity, at least the way I apply the concept of compatibilism, I think that there are libertarian free choices we can make, but when it comes to choosing Christ, it seems to me that it's very clear that I will consistently reject Christ when left on my own, and it's not because anyone's forcing me in a deterministic way to do so, but it's also not the case that I could have done otherwise. I can't do otherwise, and the reason is because my nature is in rebellion to God, and so I always choose that which is consistent with my nature. It is my nature constrains or limits the choices that I could make that are available to me. I can't do anything because my nature won't allow me. Think of God. His nature, he's not free to sin because his nature won't allow that. He always chooses within his nature in that regard. And on this point, I think we are compatibilistically free. We are free to follow our natures. Our natures are fallen, so we freely sin in that sense. And we are culpable. We are blameworthy for that. And this is why there needs to be some change in our nature, that God works so that instead of freely choosing sin and freely in the compatibilistic sense, we now freely choose him in the compatibilistic sense, and he draws us to himself. Now, I hold this view of compatibilism, just to close this out before we get back to Paul, because I think the scripture teaches it, that we were born children of wrath, that we are slaves to sin, that there is none righteous, not even one. Now, I know others have other ways of characterizing this, and they will read the text differently, and I respect that, and I'm sympathetic to the differences. I'm just saying this is what my understanding of the best reading of Scripture entails, and that's why I'm a compatibilist, at least when it comes to the salvation question, which is the most important one that we talk about. So there you go, Paul. So now we're all up to speed. Does that sound like your understanding of compatibilism?
Yeah, in fact, that was even better than you described it last year.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
And what I wanted to mention...
By the way, I don't hold the view that we always do what we want to do. I mean, that's a way that some people characterize it, especially Reformed people, and I think there's some problems with that, but that's another question.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I had a chance to meet your friend James White when he was in Chicago.
Oh, you did, huh?
Yeah, and I brought this up to him as well, and he described that... compatibilism is absolutely foundational to his apologetic.
Yeah, okay.
And the problem of evil especially.
Yeah, okay.
I wanted to see how important it was in your interaction with
It's very important in terms of my understanding of the cross. I'm trying to think. In my apologetics, it plays a role in the whole question about whether God is just or not, about punishing evil, and what about the people who never heard, and those kinds of things. Now, so I can answer the question. J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig are friends of mine, and they are both libertarian freedom guys, all right? And as a result, they're Arminians, not Calvinists.
Right.
And now, so they have a way of cashing out this issue of what about those who never heard, which they use some clever and sophisticated thinking about it with middle knowledge. Without going into detail on that, I will just say that it has no attraction to me because they are trying to solve problems with middle knowledge, using middle knowledge to solve problems that I don't have as a Calvinist. Mm-hmm. The person who never heard is still somebody who sinned against God, and in virtue of the fact that he's rebelled against God, and that this is his rebellion and it's his nature, from which this rebellion flows, then he is fully guilty for all of his behaviors and fully culpable. And God has no obligation to rescue him or anybody. So the fact that he has never heard of Jesus is not in any wise a defense against the judgment that is due him for his sin. And that, I mean, that just seems to me falls so naturally together. And so my understanding that a man's fallenness and the compatibilism that follows from it is, you know, fits, I think, nicely in this question about what about those who never heard. In fact, I developed this extensively in a tape that I do entitled The Heathen and the Unknown God. And we spend most of the time talking about theology of fallenness before we get into answering that question later in the tape. So,
sure, slaves of sin.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's completely defensible, though it's offensive to a number of people who want to play the fairness game. Well, if God were really fair, he would give everybody the equal chance. Well, fairness doesn't enter into it, frankly. It's not an issue here. And so God is not constrained by these concepts of fairness. He is constrained by justice, but he has no obligation to treat everybody the same. It's his ball game, you know. And so anyway, I think compatibilism helps me to navigate those fairly deep waters, actually. So that's how it works for me, Paul.
Sounds great.
Okay, I appreciate the call.
Thanks, Greg.
Yeah, take care. Let's go to Columbus, Ohio. And this must be another web listener. Ed, are you listening by streaming or just a download so far?
No, I'm just listening through the phone right now.
Uh-huh. Have you used the streaming yet?
No, I just found out a friend of mine just told me about it a few days ago.
Uh-huh.
You always keep up letting each other know when one of your MP3s is available.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, before long we're going to have podcasting, so you won't have to ask that question ever again. It'll just download automatically right into your machine every time it comes up. So that might be a month or two. Pardon me?
I just got an MP3 player. So
okay, well, that's great. Columbus, Ohio. Ed, what church do you go to there?
Grace Brethren.
Okay, because I got some friends from a long time ago that are pastoring at Zenos Christian Fellowship.
Yep. I remember you recommended that church before, and since I'm taking a seminary class through Trinity, which is at Zenos.
Okay, that's great. Now, you went to one of Doug Padgett's conferences, I understand.
Yeah, no, I didn't. It was actually through my young adult ministry that I serve with at Grace Brethren.
Yeah, Doug is an emergent church leader and someone who I just had a little interchange on in the blog maybe a week or so ago. Did you read that post?
I did.
On why Jesus is the only way, and he was upset about the way Christians, evangelicals, have used that to teach exclusivism, and he calls it foundationalism, but I don't think he knows what that word means, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But so that's the guy. So what's up with that?
To share with you the position I had.
You know, Ed, I don't know what's wrong with your phone, but it's breaking up terribly here. I'm going to get like every other word. Are you on a cell phone or are you on a landline or what?
I am on a landline, yeah.
Okay, it might be that there's a bad connection and when you move around, it kind of we lose you, but you're kind of in and out like that, you know, kind of thing.
You know what? It's at the worst time possible that I'm on the radio with you.
I'm sorry.
A friend's picking me up and maybe we should go, but
okay, did you go ahead and tell me your comment and let me respond to it, and if you don't hear it on the phone because you're driving, you could pick it up when you download the MP3.
Okay.
So what did Padgett say?
Well, basically some brief observations that I wanted to share was that he shared several things that were helpful and several things that I felt were could be detrimental.
Right, some helpful, some detrimental. Go ahead.
Yeah, just as you were saying, oh shoot, did I lose you?
No, I'm still here. Go ahead.
Okay, and so I wanted to share some of my brief observations.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. Well, first of all, there was the correspondent. You know, I sort of identified it as sort of correspondence theory.
Uh-huh.
As well as the coherence theory.
Okay, these are two different ways of understanding truth. Okay, good.
Yes.
And he was promoting what?
I would imagine that he was dealing with the He was sort of articulating a coherence.
Yeah, okay, no question there. I'm not surprised. I didn't know that, but I'll respond to that in a moment. Go ahead. What else?
Yeah.
I'm taking some notes here so that I get it all at once.
I would love for you to articulate the differences between the
two. Okay, be glad to do that. And what was the other thing?
He used Acts chapter 10 as a verse where here's how I'll just kind of articulate it. Okay, basically, he was saying that, you know, we each have our own truth. And then together as a community, as a body of Christ, we can then form our truth.
Okay, now Acts chapter 10, which verse did he use?
He used Acts chapter 10, and he was talking about how Peter learned some things too, just like the Jewish people learned some things.
Okay, so what is... Because Peter learned some things too, just as the Jewish people did. Actually, in Acts chapter 10, it's the conversion of Cornelius, who is a Gentile.
Okay,
that's the big event there.
Reference. I'm kind of on the go.
Okay, well that's okay. So the fact that he learned some things and the Gentiles learned some things, what follows from that about the definition of the word truth?
Well, from just my recollection, let's just go with that.
Okay.
The best thing, but. It was like, you know, the community, it's like Peter learned some things through other people, and then the other people learned some things through him.
Okay. Well, and that,
together.
So does that mean that therefore the community creates truth?
Well, that was the impression that I was getting. How I actually emailed Doug, and he hasn't had probably a chance to respond yet. I emailed him about 5 days ago.
Yeah.
And I was talking as well, I kind of set up a contrast and how I put it in diagram forms. I kind of had four circles, each with your truth in the middle of it. And then I had an arrow and then a bigger circle that says our truth. And that's how I sort of said, okay, do you agree with this or do you agree with this? And then the second one was a big circle of truth, and then, a few smaller circles with your truth there, and then an arrow.
Okay, let me respond to this, because this man is massively confused, and he's completely taken in by the cultural playing
I
with these words here. And I don't at all mean to be uncharitable to Doug Padgett. I mean, maybe he's a real nice guy. I had one blog interaction with him, and he was speaking absolute nonsense about John 14:6, and I posted on that, and he got real mad and posted something nasty and then pulled it off very quickly. I didn't read what he posted, but you know, he thought better of making a knee-jerk response. He was so frustrated with me, but there was nothing frustrating about my comment. He was talking about foundationalism, and it was clear he didn't know what it meant. He didn't even read his own link to the definition of foundationalism. It's clear he didn't, because he wouldn't have made the comments that he made. And he had some goofy take on John 14:6. Anyway, I'm not going to go off on that right now, because I've already spoken to that issue. But this notion of your truth and our truth is nonsense. And the reason I say it is because I'm going to ask then, when you say your truth or when you say our truth, what do you mean? Define for me the word truth in those clauses. And I know what they mean. They mean belief. That is your belief. And then you take your beliefs and you bring them together with other people's beliefs, and then they change your beliefs and you may change their beliefs, and then you come together and you all share a similar belief. That isn't a truth. It's a belief.
He actually said our reality and your reality. He said that to us, you know, this young adult ministry. He's like, he said our reality, in other words, Solomon's porch, and then your reality. And I so much wanted to say, well, what did you mean by that?
Yeah, well, good for you. And let me just make a point. This is one of the most important points that can be made in this discussion, and these people don't get it. They don't get it because they have been, what's the word? They have been bewitched by postmodern language.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot I could say that's behind this, okay? I mean, there's a philosophic thing that I have no confidence, though I don't know for sure, but I have no confidence that Doug Padgett understands. The postmodern view is that there is linguistic constructivism, and that means that when it comes to the way the world really is in itself, there's no way to know that. either it has no way in itself that it is, or we can't have access to it. So it turns out the only thing that we know is what we turn out inventing by our community's language.
Yep.
And that thing which we invent by our community's language is our truth.
Yeah.
Okay. And they have their truth, and I, you know, some other community, and I can't say that my community's truth is any better than their truth, because we both created our own things, you see. But in that sense, there the word truth is synonymous with belief. And all he's concerned about, really, in a truth, is that your truth, I'm putting scare quotes around it here, now you can tell, it all kind of hangs together in a sensible way. That's the coherent view. Truth is kind of like a net where all the different pieces associate with each other in a coherent way, and so you have a coherence view of truth.
Like there a spider web?
Yeah, well, no, a spider web is anchored.
Okay.
This kind of view has no anchor.
Yeah.
Because the only way to anchor it is to touch it with reality, which there is no capability of doing in the postmodern mindset. So now he's used the word reality, not as the world as it is in itself, but the reality that he created in his mind, or their group did, which he calls a truth. So now both the word reality and the word truth has come to substitute for the word belief. Now, but this creates all kind of confusion. I'm going over time. I know we got a break coming up here, but I just got to spend some time on this because it's so important. This creates all kinds of confusion, because it is very easy to show how this confusion, why this is confusion. This isn't just the assertion of Coco the Modernist. Because you could say, well, that's my reality, or that's my belief. And then I'm going to ask this question. Is there a difference between believe and make believe? Is there a difference between reality and fantasy? Can believing something make it true? Now, the answer to those questions is very important. If believing something can't make it true, then a belief is not a truth, is it? It's a belief, it's a point of view that people have about the way things are that could be true and could be false. But if my belief is my reality, then there is no unreality. There is no fantasy as long as I believe it. I can never be mistaken about the way the world really is. There is no fantasy world possible on their view as long as I believe it. There is no difference between believe and make believe. If it's a belief, then it's just as true as anything else.
Yeah, I think something else worth noting is that he, you know, according to his own views, he would say that my beliefs are just as valid as his beliefs. However, you know, talking with him and interacting with him that weekend, he, you know, it was very clear that he felt he was right.
Of course it does. They're all like that, every single one of them. Now, what does it mean for him to say he's right? It means that his view is true. And what does he mean when he says his view is true, although he won't use that language? But this is what he means. And now we're getting down to the definition of truth, that is the definition that everybody means almost every single time they use the term, except for when they're playing games like he is with reality belief statements like that. They're playing postmodern games. And what it means is that your statement fits the way the world really is. You heard Kokel on the radio yesterday. Really? Is that true? Well, if you did, then it is. And if you didn't, then it isn't. It's just that simple. To say that it's true doesn't mean that you believed it. Then there'd be no possibility of anybody lying, for goodness sake, as long as they believe their lies. You see? Either you did hear me or you didn't. It's that simple. And if you didn't, then it's not true. You might have been mistaken. You might have been fantasizing. You might have been hallucinating, but you didn't actually hear me, so therefore your statement's not true. If you did hear me, then it is true. This is very simple. You know, when somebody says, you know, when Padgett says that, you know, Kokel misrepresented my view, he didn't understand me. My question is that true? In other words, is it a fact that I misrepresented you? These guys trade on a correspondence definition of truth, which is what I just described. Your statement corresponds to the way the world really is. They trade on that definition all day long. But then when they want to do their little spiritual trips, then they change the definitions and they start talking about my reality and your reality, my truth and your truth. And they confuse the whole issue and they make it sound then like there is no real reality. Well, how do you know that? People who didn't believe in reality in the past were called insane, who couldn't tell the difference between fantasy and reality. Oh, gosh.
If I could contribute two brief observations.
Okay, hold the thoughts, and I'll come back to you, okay, because we're way over break time, and we've got to do this. But I'm just going to put you on hold, and I'll come back to you because this is such an important issue. Ed, hang on. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
You know the feeling, unsure, tentative. You remain quiet, or you're just angry. The feeling you get whenever the conversation turns to your faith and values. Want to increase your confidence and skill in discussions and feel confident when you speak up? Then Tactics is for you. Learn the techniques Greg Kokel has taught thousands of others that will help put you in the driver's seat in every exchange. You'll learn specific skills to help you initiate conversations effortlessly. Stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables. Graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking. Maneuver through minefields, and present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. You'll learn some simple tactics and skills that will have you interacting and conversing with confidence about what you believe and why. Tactics will teach you how, as you listen and follow along while Greg walks you step by step through the material as your personal tutor. Soon, your conversations with friends will look more like diplomacy than warfare, and you'll be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present your faith and the reasons why Jesus Christ is the answer. Call 1-800-2-REASON to order. 1-800-2-REASON. Or go to the web at str.org.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org. Greg Kokel back with you here, just fighting my own frustration. So thankful for this call from Ed from Columbus, Ohio, talking about Doug Padgett, who apparently taught a class or something that Ed was part of, Doug being one of the leaders in the Emergent Church, and promoting a very corrosive form of relativism. And Ed, I know these people don't like to be called relativists, but I wrote a book on relativism. I know what it is, and he's one of them.
Yeah.
And they don't understand. I looked in their book on A is for Abductive, you know, this whole thing of all the different terms of the postmodern church. When I got to relativism, they were saying, we're not relativists. And they said, here's what a relativist is. We're not one of these. We're one of these things over here. And then they give the description. It turns out the thing that they described that they thought was a relativist turned out to be an empiricist. It's like the umpire says, I call them the way I see them. That's a relativist,
yeah.
He said. That's not a relativist. That's an empiricist.
Yeah.
All right? Then he says, we're not those nasty things. We're like the umpire says, they ain't nothing till I call them. No, that's us. We're the postmoderns. Like they, we're the emergent guys. There ain't nothing till I call them. Well, that's relativism, for goodness sakes. You create reality. There is no objective truth that's the same for everybody. I mean, it's called linguistic constructivism. It's so clear to me that they've missed the boat entirely in even their understanding. And when he's talking about my reality versus your reality and your truth versus my truth and we share all truths and we all come together in one truth, he is really speaking, well, he's not exactly speaking nonsense, but he is abusing the word truth.
Well, I also think he takes advantage of our American reductionism.
Okay, in what sense? Go ahead.
Basically that we as Americans, we love to take these very important biblical concepts and water them down to a bumper sticker slogan,
mm-hmm.
which just puts us in a position where we can easily be misled.
Yeah, I think the bigger problem here is not so much reductionism, it's just misunderstanding of the nature of the things that he's talking about. Now, he does understand what he's talking about, but his understanding is consistent with a postmodern relativistic viewpoint that has no place in Christianity. And for him to have the audacity to quote anywhere out of Acts chapter 10, especially regarding his view, I mean, do you have another second here?
Sure.
I know you got to take somebody somewhere. If you need to go, just let me know. But here is Peter giving his sermon to Cornelius. The Holy Spirit told him to go to Cornelius the Gentile, and he then gives the account of Jesus here. And he says, we are witnesses of the resurrection of Christ. He talks about Jesus of Nazareth, how God anointed him with the Holy Spirit with power. And we are witnesses to all these things that he did. God raised him on the third day, verse 40 there, and granted that he should become visible. Now I got a question to ask of Doug Padgett. When he said that God raised Jesus, I want to know whether a dead man got out of a grave or not. As a matter of fact, not as a matter of coherence of religious concepts that they all fit together, but did a dead man get out of the grave? And was his name Jesus of Nazareth? Was that true? That is, did it happen? Does the claim correspond to the way the world really is? Peter presumes correspondence as an understanding of truth in his message, but he goes on. He doesn't just stop there. God raised him on the third day. He made him visible to us. We saw him. Verse 42, listen to the message. Listen to the gravity here with which Peter speaks. And he ordered us to preach to the people and solemnly to testify that this is the one who has been appointed by God as judge of the living and the dead. And of him all the prophets bear witness that through his name, everyone who believes in him receives forgiveness of sins. Now, there is no ambiguity in that statement. And this means nothing if it's not understood in a correspondence truth sense. Because Peter is saying this is the way it is, and even for this Gentile who is outside of the Jewish story, who has a different reality, according to Mr. Padgett's take on things, that man still must bend his knee to Jesus of Nazareth, who is the only Savior. There is no pluralism in this passage at all. And so there is no way to understand the gravity of this. He ordered us to preach this very clear message, which message is largely, if not completely, absent from the preaching of the emergent guys. And because they don't believe in the Great Commission, not in this sense. And I don't know how he can quote this and then start to prattle on about correspondence and about Peter had his views and the group had their views and they all come together and got a new view and everybody's got a new truth. No, Peter's saying this is the way it is. Put up or shut up. This mattered. I mean, can you see what I'm talking about, Ed?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I'm sorry for being so frustrated about this, but, I mean, there's a real battle.
I could have easily – I mean, I understand your frustration, but one thing that you really encouraged me in weeks prior, as I knew that he was coming and I became aware of him because of your show.
Uh-huh.
And
the blog post, maybe.
What's that?
The blog post where we actually –
Yeah,
you know,
that was something I looked at Friday. By the way, he spoke the whole weekend. He spoke Friday night, Saturday.
What kind of conference was this?
It was a retreat. It was a young adult ministry retreat. We went to a, you know, state park, and we were there at a lodge all weekend long.
Okay, so it's for your church then, right?
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question. And I'm sorry for – let me pick your mind a little bit more because I do not want to be unfair to people like Doug Padgett on this. Was there – you were there for most of the sessions. Is that right?
Yes, I was.
Did he ever say anything – and maybe he did, and maybe there was a lot like this that was like – solid and biblical and orthodox and you know, the kind of thing that you'd expect out of somebody who had a high view of the Scripture and was reflecting biblical truths back to young people to live by, or was all of his talks kind of permeated with this kind of thing? And I don't want to put words in your mouth. Just tell me how it was.
Yeah, I think that he definitely came. He came with an agenda that was different than the conservative evangelical church that I'm a part of, and he wanted to change our minds and have us believe something else. I definitely felt that. However, he was smart enough to know that we knew enough about the truth that he couldn't go full tilt and really take us somewhere. He had to kind of mold his message, and it caused him to be much more passive, much more vague.
Uh-huh.
Really prevented him from really making some more powerful statements, more convincing postmodern statements.
Right.
Perhaps swayed more people. And
well,
so,
Ed, I'm glad you were there. I'm just so glad that you were there, and I hope you have a chance.
Well, let me say this, Greg, because you were very encouraging the weeks prior, as I mentioned, that you said, you know, let's use these as opportunities to engage. I mean,
uh-huh.
T.A. Carson encourages this as well.
Right.
Let's be separatist,
uh-huh.
not, you know, form our, you know, circle our wagons, and you know, because that's how the world becomes more worldly. We need to be salt and light. And so I made the decision a few weeks prior that I was going to go to help, you know, use Columbo tactics.
Right.
I was going to go and protect other people as mm-hmm. another fellow brother
right.
recommended, who's also against him being a speaker. But, you know, I saw value. Let me say this, because our pastor made a decision to use him, and I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt because he's a great guy, and I didn't have a chance to talk to him, but I believe that he probably sees the modernist Christianity so much, and it's just in seeing the negative implications, the negative impact of modernism being in the church today. And so he wanted to maybe get us off of that, and so he used this postmodernist guy to kind of cause us to start thinking again,
yeah,
get us out of our slumber.
Well, I hope that
can go in and then correct and become bibliocentric.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I just am not convinced at all that the church is modernist in the way these postmodern emergent church people say it is. I don't have any confidence they understand modernism, and I don't think they understand postmodernism very well. That's why they're being taken down. The people that I know, you know, the things that I hold as that are identified as modernist tendencies were tendencies that were there a long time before Descartes and David Hume and Immanuel Kant and the rest of the crowd. You know, these go back to Aristotle, if you want to even go before Christ. You know, these were basic ways of the correspondence view of truth was defined, or at least clarified by Aristotle.
I agree
you know,
with that.
So,
I'm speaking of the, maybe I could call it hyper-modernism.
Well, whatever. I think this is just a way of kind of broad brushing and poisoning the well, basically. And anyway, we've got to move on here, Ed. I'm glad you're there, and I hope you keep challenging the people at that church, especially the leadership. You help them to see what's wrong with this guy. He is deeply confused about this notion of truth, and I know those guys don't like it when we say those kinds of things, and they're just going to write me off as a modernist. But you know what? They're going to have to do better than just call me names. I haven't called any names. I've dealt with the particular issues, and that's what we need to be doing. Thanks so much for the call, and hang in there. Wow. I tell you, I am getting more, what's the word, militant about this. These people are scary. Now, when I say that, I mean these people are nice people. They think they're doing right. They are whatever, but what they believe is dangerous. The way they're influencing the church is dangerous. And I'm not talking about having candles and alternate music and, you know, sitting in couches in your church and, you know, community and the poor. That's fine. Why would anybody care about that? I mean, the church is already dealing with the poor to a great degree. You want to emphasize that? Fine. It's what's underneath. It's the ideas that drive the enterprise. And if you buy the idea, simply put, that there is no truth in the classical sense of the term, and you implicitly buy that idea by changing the definition from correspondence to coherence, you've essentially gutted Christianity. There is nothing left Jesus is not insulin. He's ice cream, ladies and gentlemen. All right, maybe we should move on to another caller, maybe even a different topic. Arthur in El Cajon, I thank you so much for waiting.
Hi, Greg.
Hello, Arthur.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, glad to.
My sister-in-law is a practicing lesbian.
Uh-huh.
And also, I believe, a confessing Christian.
Mm-hmm.
My question is...
Well, that's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. My question is specifically, what does the Bible say about how I should relate to her and how I should allow my kids to relate to her?
Well, Well, to strictly answer your question, it doesn't say anything about how your kids should relate to her, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't inform the process. It doesn't speak to it directly. How should you relate to her as a brother in Christ? It does say something about that. And both 1 Corinthians, 5 and Matthew 18 speak to the process. Also Galatians chapter 6, the first couple verses. In Galatians 6, it says that if anybody's caught in a trespass, you who are spiritual, correct such a one, look into yourselves, lest you also be tempted. So there is the directive to correct sin in the body with a certain type of attitude. The step-by-step process is in Matthew 18. First you go alone, then you go with another brother, then you bring it before the church. Now, I'm presuming that she's a member of your community, the church in your community, and she may not be, but I'm just giving you in principle the ideas.
She is not.
Okay, but in 1 Corinthians 5, then, Paul says he's talking about somebody who is in serious sexual sin, and the Corinthians had not dealt with it, and he said that you should remove that person from your midst, because a little sin leavens the whole, a little leaven leavens the whole loaf, essentially. You allow some in there, and then more will happen, and this is not good for the body. So the biblical injunctions are to deal with it rather aggressively. Now, when you have a family member, it makes it harder, and I'm not exactly sure how best to deal with that. I mean, one way to deal with it is say, you know, this person may claim to be a Christian, but it's clear because they're celebrating immorality. And I don't know in the case of your sister-in-law, but it may be the case that she's, like many, they celebrate this as a gift from God, and the really bad people are those who think homosexuality is wrong. Those are the real evil people that God condemns, you know. They think this is what Jesus would have done, condemned all of us. And so when you have somebody who is so caught up in an immorality that they're celebrating it, and they're calling wrong right, and they're condemning those who are calling wrong wrong, and they're giving hearty approval to those who are doing like they do. And that verse or that phrase comes out of Romans chapter 1 at the end of the chapter. Well, this is a sure sign of the judgment of God. And so I personally would never presume that somebody in this circumstance living that way was a Christian. I had a pastor who was a pastor of the homosexual church here in Los Angeles a number of years ago on, and his title was Reverend such and so. And I just, you know, politely introduced him by his name, and I never referred to him as Reverend. And finally he got really bugged at me, and he says, "Why don't you call me Reverend? I'm a Reverend." And I said, "I cannot extend the right hand of fellowship to you as a brother Christian, just as I couldn't extend the right hand of fellowship to somebody who went to a church for adulterers and who thought adultery was a beautiful thing and a gift from God and celebrated it and invited all the other adulterers together to worship God as adulterers." That's just so bizarre, and I don't know why it's any different with the homosexual, because the Scripture is quite clear on this issue. And I have a whole teaching tape on this, and I know there's been some new theology come down that's trying to change the Bible on this, but I have Setting the Record Straight, The Bible and Homosexuality, is a tape that I have that you might consider.
I've listened to it, and I agree with it.
So the Bible's clear on this issue. So when it comes to a person, one of two things is the case. Either they're not a believer, and then you treat them like a non-believer. I mean, you don't correct them and whatever, but you welcome them into the fellowship. They're just not believers, no matter what they say. And if they really think they're believers and they're followers of Christ, they're part of your church, and then they ought to be corrected. This is like one of those tough things, because you got a member of family who thinks they're Christian, but I'm sure they're not if what you tell me is true. And then you know, I tell people the way you deal with homosexuals who aren't Christians is the way you deal with anybody else who's not a Christian. Nothing special, you know. You show kindness and love and grace to them. You don't judge them, and you speak the truth to them about Christ for their sin, not for any particular sin. Because if they weren't homosexual, there'd be other things that are wrong in their lives that they have to be forgiven for. So what do you think?
I agree with that. As far as not treating her as a Christian, say at Christmas time when we have all the family together, then I should not have a problem with her coming and being part of the family, but...
Well, I think it'd be hard, and this is especially difficult when you've got a family situation, to exclude members of the family on these grounds. For that. And if she is a non-believer in any other kind of sin, you wouldn't exclude her. And so I would just treat her normal. If you ever have a personal conversation with her, I would tell her you might find be comfortable in saying in a matter-of-fact way and not condescending that I have no reason to believe that you're really a follower of Jesus Christ because you are not living in a way that brings honor to him but rather to dishonor, and you celebrate it. And I don't, so, you know, something along that line. But, that's the best I can do on this one, Arthur.
Okay.
And I know it doesn't give you much of an action guide, but I take the things that I've said and then pray about it and see what other wisdom that the Holy Spirit gives you on this, all right?
All right, thank you very much.
Yeah, good talking to you. Got to go to a break. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Hugh Hewitt. Want to make a difference for a Christianity worth thinking about? Stand to Reason can help you do just that. STR trains Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Stand to Reason relies on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting in your area and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You will learn how to deliver a message that is accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a manner that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting STR Radio today. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON or send your gift to 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. Again, 1438 East 33rd Street, Signal Hill, California, 90755. And thank you for listening.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org.
It's been a hard day's night, and I've been working like a dog.
Now, why does this sound like a good song for me right now? Jimmy sleeping. Well, this takes me back to my freshman year in high school, man. This is cool. Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand to Reason. And I do get a little weary fighting this battle about, about the issue of truth and in our own ranks. But it's worth the fight, ladies and gentlemen, because this is our Waterloo. This is a goal line stand. If I can find the right metaphor here, this is where it matters. This counts, all right? We're not talking about angels dancing on the head of a pin here. All right, continuing here with our long-suffering callers who have been waiting for so long. Joseph in Laguna Hills, California. Welcome to the show, Joe.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
Just want to let you know you're not the only one weary. I'm picking up. I'm actually going to start teaching Christian apologetics at Coast Hills in Aliso Viejo.
Oh, good for you. Oh, that's great.
I'm going to use part of your curriculum. That was part of why I called, just to let you know that.
Well, thank you, Joseph, and I'm just kudos to you. I'm glad to hear it.
Pretty much going to use a mixture of Geisler's Apologetics, yours, and I forget who else, and then in the end result, I'm going to try to get your tactics in defending the faith and bring some students through it.
Okay, that's great, because that'll supplement the rest of the things. You know, we sometimes get information heavy in our instruction, and then people say, okay, I got all this information, I don't know how to use it. And I think what the tactics does, particularly starting with the Colombo tactic, is it gives people a game plan.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to get, well, in the future, honestly, I know I'm trying to get you to come down to our church. I don't know if you're already trying to with another men's ministry.
You mean if they've contacted us? We don't usually try in the sense of contacting other churches. We wait for them to contact us, and we see what we can work out. So that may be in the mix. I don't know.
Oh, sorry. I think you've already been contacted.
Oh, okay, good.
I'm hearing this from the side. I was trying to get you into my class.
Okay. Well, I do both. It's fine with me if our schedule allows it. The enforcer, Melinda, handles those details, so I usually don't know much about it until I'm about ready to go up and see you guys. So you might call her about those details at the office.
Secondly, I saw your notes on the website on Metaphysics 1.
Right. This was a course that Melinda and I both took with J.P. Moreland about 10 years ago now.
Okay.
And since so many people were taking that course, we put our notes, we made them available, so it makes it easier for them, I think.
Well, why? I was going to ask you, why don't you have Metaphysics 2 up there? Is one harder or longer? Because yours is 95 pages of notes.
I'm, yeah, right.
Not looking at it.
Well, there are a couple of reasons. Metaphysics 1 is a particular thing. It's a foundation in metaphysics. So you talk about substance and properties and things like that, you know, and you get the basics there. Metaphysics 2 is not a particular thing. It's a seminar class that goes in different directions for different classes. So I've taken Metaphysics 2, but I did it on the issue of materialism, naturalism, and with J.P. Moreland. But I'll tell you, so that's one of the reasons. But another reason is it's a whole lot of work to put those outlines together, and we happened to do it for that class, but we just didn't have the time to do it for the other ones.
Okay, and that makes sense. I've seen Metaphysics 2, Metaphysics of Agency. Now I understand now.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, the reason I was asking is I'm a Talbot student also, and I'm going to be going through there. I'm doing the 10-year plan, but...
Yeah, that's like me.
Plugging away.
Yeah, well, good for you. Yeah, the Metaphysics 1 everybody takes, and it's reasonably standardized, and that's why we did these notes for ourselves, and so we just thought we'd make them available, and I guess they've circulated quite a bit.
I can use them, so thank you so much, and I just want to give you praise for your ministry. I've been financially supporting you guys for years. I'm going to plug some students into your thoughts.
Thank you so much, Joseph. Keep up the good work. Just pass it on, okay? Yeah, thanks. Glad to hear from you. Now let's go to Wheeling, Illinois, one of my old stomping grounds. Deborah, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I'm too kind of weary from that call, but maybe this will energize you. I just checked out your book on relativism from the Wheeling Library a couple of
No kidding. All right.
Yeah, I sure did.
Huh.
And then I thought I should call and ask you my question.
Okay.
Tell me how to answer this question to a non-believer.
All right.
And his question is, since the law wasn't given until after the flood, how did the people before the flood know that they were sinning so badly?
Yeah, okay, that's a great question. I mean, it's a very understandable question from somebody on the outside. There's a very simple answer to this. By the way, that I can make the problem harder. It's compounded. It's not just the problem of those before the flood or anybody before the law. But it's anybody outside of the purview of the declaration of the Mosaic Law. So everybody in the world besides the Jews, even though the law was given to Moses, it wasn't given to the whole world. It was given to the Jews.
Right.
So it isn't like, you know, the Canaanites didn't have that thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, so you've got that problem too. And the answer is that it is based on a misunderstanding of what the law entailed. Of course, we have the word law in English, and this is a word that we use that encapsulates, oftentimes the word is used to describe or capture the first five books of Moses, also known as the Pentateuch, the five books, or the Jews called it the Torah, which means instruction or teaching. And so when you think of it, if you think of all of that as the law, like here's the only place you can find the law, well, I can see this would be a problem. But the Torah, those five books which we call the law, it entailed a lot of different things. The history of Israel up to a point, and then you've got the Exodus where this more specific law is given. And the reason for giving that which is called the law, generally, is not to, as a means of informing people of morality. It isn't like, well, look, I'm in the state of California, but I don't know what the laws are here unless somebody tells me. So you're going to give me a ticket for breaking a law, but nobody ever made the law available to me. It isn't like that. The law, the Hebrew law, was given to organize the nation of Israel as a distinct culture. When you organize a country or a peoples as a distinct culture, you have laws that deal with lots of different things. Some of them are very foundational things, like more like don't murder, don't steal, that kind of thing. And other ones are more particular and even peculiar to a particular culture. Well, all of that kind of stuff is in the Hebraic law. But it isn't as if nobody knew that it was wrong to kill until Moses wrote it, or until God wrote it on the tablets. Since God was making a law for everybody, he's putting the obvious things down there for people to clearly see, and then he's adding a whole bunch of other things that people don't know about. It is these obvious things, or what Paul calls the law that's written on our hearts, and this is in Romans chapter 2. The law is the written on the heart of every human being, regardless of whether he read Moses or not. And it's on the basis of the law written in the heart, the conscience, if you will, the knowledge every person has of right and wrong, even apart from reading anything anywhere. That was the basis of God's judgment. He said that wickedness was on the mind of people all the time. They were always doing evil. They were killing and murdering and all that kind of stuff. And you don't need somebody to tell you that's wrong to know that it's wrong. That's something that's obvious. And so when God judged the people in the flood, they already knew what was wrong. You know, even when you read in Genesis chapter 18 and verse 25, you have Abraham, arguing with God about Sodom and Gomorrah, and he doesn't want him to destroy the whole city if there's some righteous people in there. And he says this, "Far be it from you, shall not the judge of all the earth deal justly?" In other words, do what's right. Well, how did Abraham know what's right? It was another 400 years before the law was given. Even Abraham knew what justice was. It was built in. That's the point. And so what you want to do is explain to your non-Christians, is that the Christian answer, since they're looking for the biblical answer, how do you make sense of this from within the biblical worldview? You explain to them, well, the law really was a constitution for a government. And it included the moral things that are part of any government, but it included them in part because people already knew that these things were wrong. And that's why every culture has laws reflecting some of these kinds of things. And it was these things that are written on the heart, that are in the conscience of human beings, regardless of whether they read Moses, that God judged the people before the flood on the basis of. Does that make sense?
That makes perfect sense. Is there a way to go about it without appealing to Scripture?
No, it's entirely appropriate, because the question is, how do you account for God judging those in the flood prior to the giving of the law? So it is a challenge to the Christian worldview and the biblical account of things. So it's important to be able to give the biblical answer. Don't let them weasel out by saying, well, you're speaking from the Bible, because the challenge is against the Bible. And so they're saying something's wrong with your system. The law doesn't come until after the judgment. So how can he judge? You say, well, everybody, according to our system, everybody already knows that. And I think they're aware of that too. Everybody already knows that. Deborah, thank you for the call. We're all done, folks. And it's been a fast day. Next week, I'll be back with more Clear Thinking Christianity. In the meantime, be a good ambassador. Apply the things that you've learned here and give them heaven. All right. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye now.